Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Carolyn Walsh, and I will be reading from the Boston Globe's Sunday Globe magazine. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. So the Globe magazine feature article is about your home, downsizing to small spaces, inspired ideas for making the most of a minimal footprint. So the opening one, charmed by the wood-lined guest studio at her daughter's house, a retired hotelier remade her one-bedroom Concord condo to evoke its warmth. And it does show a large photo of a lot of wood-paneled wall space, a beautiful sofa in a nice, rich color. And from there, we will start. Contemplating downsizing from her single-family home in Concord, Mary Diem, D-I-E-M, an 80-year-old former hotelier with a calm yet commanding presence and loads of style, had her eye on a nearby building. When a 1,150-square-foot garden-level unit came up, she contacted architect Doug Jack to remake it into an easy-to-navigate, chic, and cozy home with plenty of storage, an open floor plan, and more natural light. Diem cited very specific inspiration for the home's look and feel. Her daughter, Pam Diem Willis, and son-in-law, Chris Willis, owners of Pammy's Restaurant in Cambridge, have a warm, wood-lined guest studio in Martha's Vineyard where Mary stays when she visits. She said, "I want a wood house too," Pam says. Jack, who was the project architect on that home under a prior employer, he since founded his own firm, Nidify Studio, and that is spelled N-I-D-I-F-Y. He knew replicating DM's daughter's space wasn't the answer. "The studio is completely lined in salvaged hemlock," he explains. "That much natural wood wouldn't fit the budget or feel appropriate for a concrete building in a Boston suburb." How to apply wood in a more authentic and affordable manner? Jack's solution was a carved, curved accent wall that sweeps from the entry through to the living room. The feature comprises white-oaked tongue-and-groove planks in a mix of 4 and 6 inch wide. Narrower boards navigate the curve. The wider boards, interspersed for a wabi-sabi effect, better fill the larger scale of the living room. The accent wall greets you at the door, draws you in, and winds you through towards the light in the seating area, tying the spaces together, the architect says. The deeper fix was the floor plan and overarching shell. The bones of the brick-clad concrete building, a one-time school from the 1920s, remained institutional. Ceilings felt unsettlingly high. The bedroom was cavernous. Soffits concealed ductwork with no apparent design intent. Worst of all, the kitchen was sealed off in the darkest corner of the unit, as far as possible from the sole light source, the slider, to a small patio. Jack pulled the kitchen out of the dark corner off the entry, converting that space into a 100-square-foot storage room with laundry. He preceded the space with the proper entry with bench and coat closet. The new kitchen occupies a long swath beyond the entry, with a 7-foot island, white quartz counters that fold up the wall, and white oak cabinetry. Across from the island, Jack carved a bar with the hanging glass shelves and into the wood accent wall. Beside it, a foot-deep pantry sits behind a barely discernible jib door. The awkward soffit became an asset here. Jack deliberately extended it to create a dropped ceiling across the kitchen, its leading edge sculpted to echo the curve of the white oak accent wall. "We riffed on what was there to break down the scale of the space so it's comfortable," he says. The ceiling pops back up in the dining area just past the kitchen. Still, it feels intimate. A blue dot table and hay chairs nestle in front of the existing built-in bookcase, which Jack refinished with oil to approximate the tone of the kitchen cabinets. He reassembled it selectively. Fewer shelves, more breathing room to read as a modern, decorative backdrop. As he made the room for the sideboard by sealing a 2 feet of space from the oversized bedroom next door. Opposite, the wood accent wall turns the corner to envelop the seating area, where a mid-century modern leather sofa from Reside in Cambridge faces the patio studio. It was important for the living space to connect to the outdoors for a natural, light, fresh air, and sounds of birds, Jack says. Here the wood boards help mitigate the room's jarring height. The bedroom, gargantuan and impersonal, also needed attention. Jack took cues from the boxed-in ductwork and carried the soffit around the perimeter of the sleeping space to define it and bring it down to scale. Then he added the vertical louvers that divide the area from a new dressing zone and desk. The screen allows light to filter through while preserving privacy. In the bathroom, white oak lines the wall behind the vanity and climbs about halfway up two others. The two-tone tiled shower boasts a bench and grab bars that are wholly part of the design. Accessibility was considered throughout. It simply isn't obvious. A 25-year-old would be happy here, too, Pam says. Mary loves the condo more than she imagined, conceding she should have made the move sooner. Think about downsizing at 65. Seriously consider at 70. And move while you're healthy, she says. Small is all you need. Excuse me. So next is about a South Boston family. And they find that less, done right, is more than enough. A handwritten sign across the street from a neighborhood playground led Margaret and Sean Duddy to their new home. A compact colonial townhouse with a small courtyard on a corner lot in Southie. Built in 1885, the 1,426-square-foot home had seemingly last been touched in the 1970s. The couple asked architect Timothy Pingree, and that is P-I-N-G-R-E-E, and contractor Lucas Robertson, co-owners of Shake Architecture Plus Construction, for a redesign that would make city life work for their family of four. We looked to maximize what was there and invest in quality, adding rooms we didn't need. Excuse me, that's looking for investing in quality over adding rooms that they didn't need. Adding front and rear shed dormers, both matching the slope of the roof next door, allowed Pingree and Robertson to fit two children's bedrooms and a bath on the top floor. Before, you could only stand in the center of the space. The modification adds 132 square feet. The dormers spring up from the ridge of the gable roof, lifting up the ceiling. The key to the metamorphosis was rethinking the home's structural system. The original roof was held up by load-bearing walls that essentially sliced through the middle of every floor, dividing each one into a front room and a back room. This kept the team from creating an open floor plan on the first level, as well as rejiggering the layout to accommodate a primary suite and small office on the second floor. The solution? A post and beam approach. The team installed a Douglas fir beam under the ridgeline of the roof. Both ends are held up by Douglas fir posts that run from the newly dug out basement, an effort that added 329 square feet to the top floor. A new four-story stacked staircase runs beside the post on the left side of the house, ending under a pair of skylights. The new system and staircase granted flexibility on where to place walls, or not, as on the ground floor. Here the kitchen flows from the front of the home into the dining room, which transitions into the living space, and finally out to the new bluestone patio, just as the Duddies imagined. The post and beam are the home's anchoring aesthetic element, one that reminds the family of Margaret's grandparents' place in Vermont as much as its structural tone. It's a real moment for the house and makes us feel like we're home, Margaret says. As for the now 1,887-square-foot home at the center of their day-to-day rhythms, the couple couldn't be happier. The cool thing about living in the city is that the house is not palatial. It keeps the family close, Sean says. And the next one in the small spaces, a house wide open A flexible, creative approach helps a 30-something Vermont couple build a budget-driven 800-square-foot sustainable dream home. And the photo of this, it looks very much like a box, really. And it's dark in color, but very square. Two-story. Sam Gabriels and Chrissy Bellmeyer were no strangers to small living. Before they met, Bellmeyer designed and lived in a tiny house on wheels, and Gabriel spent 4 years living out of a van, looping the country to organize pop-up farm-to-table dinners alongside Michelin star chefs. So when the couple bought a half-acre lot in Waitsfield, Vermont's Mad River Valley, in a development called the Waitsfield 10, where neighbors help each other, 800 square feet didn't seem like a constraint. Architectural designer and builder Andy White of Boreal Design started by creating a simple 20 by 20 foot box that was drywalled, then painted in a weekend. Inside it, White built the living spaces as independent, self-supporting platforms arranged at staggered heights. He describes the plan as a counterclockwise spiral. Down one step from the entry into the living room, up two into the kitchen, up one more into the dining room. The level variations define each space. If built traditionally with two floor plates and 9-foot ceilings, the house would feel claustrophobic. Here, you experience the full interior volume with long sight lines from corner to corner. Without walls dividing the public spaces, rooms morph to fit current needs and individual elements do double or triple duty. For example, the open cubbies that store Gabriel's vinyl collection are often purchased for overflow dinner party guests in the dining room and extra seating in the living room. Initially, White worried, unnecessarily, that the living room was too small and lacked a wall for a television. The couple got a projector and a screen and noted that the deck expands the experience. The mechanicals and storage are under the floors. Upstairs, the 8-by-12-foot space in front of the primary bedroom is both a closet slash dining area and mini lounge. In the morning, guests might wander over from the second bedroom to chat. During parties, it's another spot to hang out. We're very open people, so it works for us, Gabriel says. If things change, the couple could add standard-sized French doors to hide their bed. The second bedroom, which already has a pocket door for privacy, could absorb the office nook beside it to become the larger bedroom. The materials palette celebrates what's commonly available. Nothing is precious. Everything is considered. Walls and ceilings throughout are CDX fir plywood, construction-grade sheathing that is normally hidden behind drywall. Structural fir posts, usually buried, are left exposed. The couple planned, sanded, and stained the posts and sanded all of the plywood, removing lumberyard stamps. In place of galvanized joist hangers, White uses inexpensive angle steel, spray-painted black. Running the length of the staircase and bracketing the bedroom thresholds, it's the home's signature accent. It matches the corrugated metal that is distinctive, inexpensive, easy to install, and low maintenance. Sustainability was non-negotiable. 14-inch thick, cellulose-filled walls push the dwelling past passive house standards for insulation and air tightness. They also leave deep windowsills that double as seating, plant shelves, and such. The utility bill for the all-electric home averages just over $100 per month, excluding internet. Decor-wise, color does the talking. The bright yellow kitchen and pink-tiled bath are odes to homes that Gabriel's admired in New Mexico, Oregon, and California. We took a Pacifico beer bottle cap to Home Depot to find the right canary yellow for the cabinets. White says his construction methods made it easy to add on to the home, although the couple has no plans to do so. Rather, they hope to build an ADU, which is an accessible dwelling unit, to offer housing to others in the community. This is a mid-income development. making it cheaper than the median house price, but not attainable for everyone, Bellmeyer says. Meanwhile, they're grateful for White's unconventional approach, fulfilling their wish list within the square footage their budget allowed. White deflects the praise back onto the couple. The home wouldn't have come together in the way it did for anyone else. It's very much theirs, he says. Chrissy and Sam's vision, willingness to take risks and reimagine typical rooms, informed the design more than any specific space-saving or building strategy. Now, there is one, a second story going up. Instead of out, gave a family in Beverly Cove three bedrooms and a bath and a downstairs built for how they live. Before renovating their 1,000-square-foot Cape Cod-style home in Beverly Cove, Emily Lund and Dan Elsinger affectionately called it the clown house. So adept were they at stuffing it full with family and friends. About 12 years after moving in, they decided to expand. We both work from home, and our daughter, who's now 13, was sharing a room with her little brother, Lund says. Hesitant to sacrifice the yard and encroach upon their neighbors, the couple was intrigued by architect Megan McNamara's proposal to go up instead of out. Engineers determined that the foundation of the 1948 home could indeed support another level. So the team tore off the roof and built an 800-square-foot second story, complete with a new gable roof. McNamara was thoughtful about the look and feel of the exterior. We didn't want to just plop a box on top of a box in this quaint New England neighborhood, she says. Although the walls of the addition align with the existing walls on all four sides, the dormer steps in slightly to avoid a bulky, top-heavy effect. Using square awning windows there helped, too. A shed roof with metal cladding overhangs the first floor in front for added appeal. The next big question was where to locate the staircase up to the three bedrooms and family bath. McNamara put it in back, roughly where the closets that separated the original two bedrooms stood. The former primary bedroom on the left became a slightly smaller, tucked-away office for Elsinger. The kids' former bedroom, now slightly larger, became the living room. The family's existing sofa even fit perfectly beside the new stairs. Above it, Lung hung a collection of thrifted, nature-themed artwork. To create a sense of expansiveness, McNamara widened the opening between the living room and the kitchen, where she carved out a dining alcove with a built-in banquette from the space that accessed the attic stairs. In a tight footprint, it helps to see rooms beyond, and preferably the outdoors, too, she says. She likes this approach better than demolishing partitions altogether because it results in cozy moments. Family dinners feel grounded now, Lund says. In addition to the newfound privacy and ability to host, Lund says the slow work of imbuing the home with personality has been a fantastic exercise in restraint as she waits for the right pieces to pop up on the Facebook Marketplace and such. I've gained confidence in my funky style, Lund says. I can feel the house becoming more for us. So that ends that article as far as what people do with small spaces or downsize into small spaces. So let's move on to... Okay, this is Upfront. It is Inside, the Big Day, On the Block, Ocean Connections, various components to this article. So in this is a perspective my mother sacrificed to care for her mother. Those years deserve recognition as work. This is by Lauren Booker. When I was a kid, people called me my mother's shadow. We both had small glasses and rich brown skin, and wherever she went, I followed. My mother, Sylvia Wilson, shared a similar bond with her mother, Betty Hill, though forged through much harder circumstances. As a child, my mom had frequent seizures that required hospital visits. My grandmother was by her side. So when my grandmother fell ill in her late 50s, my mother had a choice: send her to a nursing home or take care of her herself. It's a decision many people face with aging parents, especially now, as baby boomers reach retirement age. Remembering how her mother was always there for her, my mother decided to become my grandmother's caregiver. She was happier being with her daughter, my mom says. She wanted to be home. That was in 2003. She took care of my grandmother for the next 20 years as her health challenges worsened. My mother cherished the time she spent with my grandmother, but she made sacrifices no one should have to, including her physical health and her financial stability. Last year, there were 63 million family caregivers in the United States, according to the Caregiving in the U.S. report by AARP and the National Alliance for Caregiving. Most were unpaid. My mother credits her caregiving for being the reason my grandmother lived as long as she did. She had seen my grandmother neglected during short nursing home stays for rehabilitation. To put a price on caregivers' collective labor, their 49.5 billion hours exceeded $1 trillion in economic value for the U.S. economy in 2024, another OPP report found. Caregiving is real work, Kathleen Roming, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says. What would our economy look like if we didn't have people raising kids or taking care of elders or taking care of family members with disabilities? I used to ask myself if I'd follow in my mother's footsteps if she needed care. Could our bond be stronger than the things I'd have to sacrifice, the rising cost of living and the lack of support for caregivers? It's a tough question, and I can't help but think of the concessions my mother has already made. I saw my mother, a member of the sandwich generation, juggle mothering me, working as a school bus driver, and taking care of my mother. My grandmother battled diabetes, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, and a few mini strokes. Those ailments kept her from driving a car and required her to use a walker. My mother drove her, cooked her food, and administered her insulin shots. In 2019, my grandmother was diagnosed with kidney failure and lost the ability to walk. Nursing home staff told my mother she'd have to quit her job to bring my grandmother home. So she did. For 5 years, my mother performed even more intensive care, administering bed baths, providing wound care, turning my grandmother in bed. I had to learn how to do total care, Mom says. 55% of black family caregivers provide high-intensity care, like my mother did, according to a 2025 AARP Caregiving in the U.S. African-American/Black Family Caregivers Profile. That's about 10 percentage points higher than the AARP's estimate of high-intensity caregivers among all adults. In 2024, my mother was so worn down by the physical labor, emotional stress, and administrative work of caregiving. During a routine checkup, her doctor observed signs of an impending heart attack or stroke. She was rushed to a hospital where she was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, a heart rhythm disorder. Sustained stress can wear down caregivers' immune and cardiovascular systems, says Paula Sherwood, a nurse, scientist, and professor at the University of Virginia. It's like walking down the street and meeting a bear. You have this fight or flight response, she says. And normally, once the situation resolves, then the bear goes away. Then everything goes back down to normal. But for a caregiver, the bear never goes away. My mother's AFib, and that's the abbreviation for the atrial fibrillation. So her mother's AFib weakened her body and prevents her from walking unassisted. However, when she applied for Social Security disability insurance, she was denied. She hadn't worked enough over the previous 10 years because she had a work gap from taking care of my grandmother. Her Social Security retirement projections have also taken a hit because the calculation is based on a person's 35 highest earning years. It hurts, but there's nothing you can do about it, she says. I can't find a job because of my health problems, and I can't go back to driving a school bus. Legislation could help. The Social Security Caregiver Credit Act, would help boost Social Security retirement credits by up to 5 years for caregivers who left the workforce but provided care for at least 80 hours per month. There's also the Credit for Caring Act that would give eligible caregivers a tax credit for up to $5,000 a year. U.S. Senator Ed Markey's Caring for Caregivers agenda is crafted to address the needs of family caregivers, including increasing access to respite care. Markey says he was inspired by watching his father care for his mother after she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's with very limited assistance. These caregivers are heroes, but heroes need help, he told me. My father deserved more help, more support. Your mother deserved more help, more support. Millions of families have a story that mirrors my family's story and your family's story. Bills in the Caring for Caregivers agenda are currently in the Senate, along with the Social Security Caregiver Credit Act. The Credit for Caring Act was referred to in the House Ways and Means, with President Trump preoccupied with a long-shot election overhaul bill. I don't have hope that any of these bills will become law anytime soon. After my mother's AFib diagnosis, I confronted the question I had asked myself years earlier. I chose to be there for her as much as I could, flying to care for her during extended stays. I drove her to doctor's appointments, managed her medicine, and cooked her meals. I provided emotional support through her new reality and through my grandmother's deaths months later. Right now, she doesn't need my full-time care. But if that changes, I will be there. Okay, so let's move on to the next article. And this is The Big Day, as I had referenced earlier, from Boston College teammates to husband and wife. Gabby and Mark learned how to support each other as athletes. It's a skill they'll carry into their marriage. It was summer of 2019, and Gabriella Teagan and Matthew Deneve were on their second date, enjoying pizza and conversation at Frank's Pepe's Pizzeria in Chestnut Hill. Gabby had just graduated from Boston College. Matt was a senior studying biology. They had been teammates for 3 years on the BC swim and dive team, where Matt, a swimmer, quietly had a crush on Gabby, a diver. In the city for a summer internship, Matt had texted her out of the blue a few weeks prior, asking her on a date. Over drinks and appetizers at Earl's in the Prudential Center, everything flowed so well, Gabby said. I think we both walked away like, wow, that was an awesome first date. A week later, as they sat at the table laughing, getting to know each other, an older woman approached them. She told them she had been watching them as they were deep in conversation and was impressed by their rapport. You guys are just so in love, and it's so nice to see, recalled her saying. We very much were caught off guard, he says. I think we both thought in the back of our heads, wow, is that some kind of sign? Soon, Gabby and Matt were talking more frequently. Matt had swim practice twice a day, plus meets, and Gabby, having just graduated from a pre-med track, was working in Boston as a medical assistant while she studied for the MCAT and researched medical schools. But they made an effort to see each other. I was really enjoying her company, Matt says. By December 2019, they were officially a couple. By spring 2020, COVID shutdowns came along. Matt headed home to Holland, Michigan, to finish college remotely, while Gabby stayed in Westwood with her family. We had only been dating for 6 months, but we liked where things were going, Gabby said. It made us take a hard look at the relationship, maybe earlier than we anticipated, to say, how serious are we about this? They decided to date long distance. Matt soon relocated to Indianapolis for his job with a pharmaceutical company, while Gabby worked in the Boston area. The couple tried to see each other at least once a month, with Matt, who worked remotely and was enrolled in an MBA program at Purdue University, often flying to Boston. Spring 2022 brought a pivotal point, where Gabby was accepted at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. The couple decided to move in together to an apartment in Winston-Salem, North Carolina that summer. But with medical school came new challenges. Long days and nights of studying paired with hospital hours that changed frequently. For some rotations, Gabby's shifts began at 5 a.m. I would switch my schedule. We would go to bed at 9 p.m. so that she could get up at 4:30, and I'll sleep an extra hour, but then I'll get up early so that we can be on the same page. So we're going through it together, and we're able to tackle it together. Each credits the other for making it work. It would have been very easy for her to just work and then say, I'm too tired, I don't want to go out, Max says. But she is great at pushing us, like, yes, I just came off a night shift, but let's go out for breakfast. Gabby's schedule also meant Matt had lots of time on his own. While working full-time, he finished his MBA remotely, learned golf, and became a better cook, often having dinner ready for Gabby when she got home from school, and breakfast waiting after a night shift. Having a strong partner in Matt helped her succeed, Gabby said. We always joked that Mac got an honorary degree because he supported me so much. It just showed how we were always teammates in college. We kind of molded well together. We just knew how to be teammates with each other. And so when I started medical school, this was just a whole nother level of commitment from my teammates. It became pretty clear that this is going to be the person I want to spend my life with. But they were in no rush, she says. We were so caught up in how much fun we were having together and taking on all of these challenges. In summer 2024, the couple went to look at rings. Gabby knew Matt would want her parents' approval. They'd next see her parents at the holidays, and she thought a proposal wouldn't come until after then. On a Sunday in October, Matt told Gabby he was going golfing, complaining about an early tea time. They woke up before dawn, he dressed in golf clothes, she in scrubs in her shift, and they left the house together. He hopped on the first flight of the day to Logan, met her parents for breakfast, asked for and received their blessing, and returned to Charlotte by dinner. The next month, on a Friday, Gabby had a big exam. Matt made reservations for a fancy dinner, as he often would when he knew she was coming off of a difficult week. On the drive over, they stopped at a park that reminded them of the Chestnut Hill Reservoir, which they frequented at BC. Walking along the water, Matt led Gabby to a spot with a blanket, flowers, and champagne, which Gabby's sisters had arranged. I guess the woman in the pizza place was right, Matt began to lead off his proposal. When they finally headed off to dinner, both families were waiting at the restaurant to surprise her. The couple chose the Fairmount Copley Plaza for the May 9th, 2026 celebration, 1 week before Gabby's med school graduation. The bride stayed true to what she had dreamt of as a child. She wore a snow-white ball gown and the color scheme centered on pink. I wanted to be like a princess for the whole day. I want to get married at a venue that might look like a European venue, says the bride, who chose the Cathedral of the Holy Cross for the ceremony. A Jesuit priest from B.C., whom the couple was close to during the college days, married them in front of 220 guests. The Catholic Church requires couples to complete pre-cana, a program of classes and counseling that covers topics from finances to conflict resolution. It pushed us in a couple places that we hadn't talked about before, Matt said. We almost made a list. There are 5 or 6 things we probably need to talk more about before we get married. Those conversations led to a tradition they call State of the Unions, where every 6 months we check in with each other, Gabby says. We're like, okay, how's work going for you? Where do you feel like you can improve? How's our relationship going? I think the big part of that came from going to BC and having instilled these Jesuit values of reflection and discernment. The couple will have lots for the agenda, if not lots of time, as newlyweds. In June, they moved to South Boston so Gabby could be in a 7-year surgical residency program at Brigham and Women's Hospital. You know how to enjoy the small moments because they're just as good as the big ones, Matt says. This article has been written by Carrie Simonelli. She is a multi-platform editor at the Boston Globe. So let's look a little bit at some of the real estate. This is always an article in the magazine here. They'll have two featured homes, both for sale, and they will always list, you know, this very specific details. So for one that's on the block, Coastal Cool, enjoy ocean views and sea breezes from these North Shore homes. So the first one is listed at $965,000. It last sold for $740,000 in 2020. It's in Nahant. It has square feet of 2,808, and it sits on a lot of 0.14 of an acre. So the pros for this house, it's set on the hill of Little Nahant Island. This 1955 cape with ocean views is a short walk to two beaches. Left off the entry hall, the open living area features hardwood floors, gas fireplace, dining area with bay window and a kitchen with granite counters, stainless appliances, and a back tile splash. A glass door opens to the wraparound composite deck with ocean views. A bedroom, family room, and newer bath round out the first floor. Up a staircase with nautical rope accents, the second floor holds two ocean view bedrooms with vaulted ceilings, plus a bath, reading nook, and a landing with skylights and storage. The walkout basement holds an exercise room, laundry, and garage. The cons against this, middle and high schools are in neighboring Swampscott. So now the second piece of property. This is, the asking price is $1,100,000. It last sold for $464,000 in 2013. It is located in Rockport. Square foot is 2,400. Has condo fee of $160 a month. Bedrooms are four, baths are two plus one half. The pros associated with this is it's perched high from the Atlantic. Three-story townhouse dates back to 1832. From the driveway with two deeded parking spaces, a lush and private three-tier stone patio with gazebo leads to a mudroom with nearby half bath. Step into a renovated kitchen with custom cherry cabinets, double drawer dishwasher, induction stove, and greenhouse window over the sink that is open to a family room with a dry bar, a dining room, and ocean view living room with pellet stove. The second floor landing links two bedrooms to a spacious bar with laundry. Excuse me, that spacious bath with laundry. Third floor, with views of the Shailen Lu Performance Center across Sandy Bay, holds a studio and a primary bedroom with reclaimed mahogany closet doors. The cons to this, original fireplaces are blocked. We'll move on to Connections, a comic book hero returns. This is written, by Sarah Farazan, and she is based in Massachusetts and writes books for young readers. The first comic book store I ever remembered going to wasn't technically a full-on comics shop. When I was five, when my mother would take me on Fridays after school to Bob's Wayband News, I had vague memories of Bob Smith himself. He had tufts of white hair, wore glasses, and always gave me a smile when I sadled up to the counter with my friends. A Laffy Taffy, a Trupp's Juice Bar Bubblegum, and an issue of Jughead's Double Digest. This was one of my greatest childhood routines, a moment of pure transactional bliss, knowing I'd spend that Friday afternoon reading about Jughead devouring burgers, the rest of my night consumed by Belky Bartomicus on Perfect Strangers as he learned the ways of America as part of the TGIF lineup. Sadly, Bob Smith passed away, and the store went with him in 2001, a blow for the community and my childhood. But that feeling of occasionally needing giddy kid comfort never quite vanished. And neither did my love of comics or the places that sell them. Imagine my joy when I wandered into the Outer Limits on Moody Street in Waltham one day in 2015. Operated by Steve Higgins since 1983, the store is in an attic of childhood wants and dreams that would please any age group. Among the things I have purchased there over the years, a Gremlins lunchbox, a Jordan Knight doll still in the box. And in parentheses, I brought said doll to a New Kids show at Fenway in 2017. The security guard called it creepy, but my fellow NKOTB fans asked if they could pose with it for photos. End of the parentheses. And for the NKOTB, that's an acronym for the New Kids on the Block. The last one is a DC Comics graphic novel I wrote. Always supportive, Steve asked me to autograph the books and generously displayed them up front. I would take them off his hands when they weren't selling. I've also purchased things that have sparked joy from places including Comikaze in Somerville, Comically Speaking in Reading, and Friar Tuck's in Brookline. Every one of these establishments, they all know Steve and have glowing things to say about him. And guess what? Places such as Omar's World of Comics in Lexington and the Million Year Picnic in Harvard Square, hubs of colorful books, posters, games, and ephemera that evoke wildly specific and long-forgotten memories, are also filled with folks who like that stuff. I suspect for many of us who have visited the Outer Limits, it has never been about the stuff. When Steve announced on the store's Instagram page in January that he was retiring at the end of July, a flood of well-wishers posted online and have come to the store not only to congratulate him on his retirement, but to share their memories of the place and the great guy who's been part of their lives for years. I can't speak for every one of his customers, but my favorite part of going to the Outer Limits is seeing Steve. We talk about classic movies, and his wife Donna recently watched current events, his grandchildren, and pop culture moments so specific it's as though we're speaking another language. It always inspires me to see someone who works hard every day surrounded by things he and so many of us are passionate about. Steve has assured worried customers like myself that it will be a seamless transition. The store will be owned and operated by someone else and will be in good hands for years to come. It's a bit of a relief, but now as I look at my room full of trinkets, they feel a little more plastic than magic. After all, a vintage Donatello figure of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fame never asked me how I'm doing. Steve always did. A guy who was surrounded for decades by fictional heroes was the genuine article to so many of us all along. Okay, let's move on to another article here. So this is Style Watch. Here comes the sun. A Back Bay kitchen finds polish and light with help from a steel and glass partition. The new owners of this riverside condo on Beacon Street appreciated the idea of a condo that flowed into a living space. That's a kitchen that flowed into a living space. That said, they preferred that the kitchen open to the living room rather than to the den. They want privacy in the back where the husband could work or the teens could watch TV. So we added a wall to close it off. And this was from Sylvia Pagan Westfall, who is the owner of Herringbone and Brass. Conversely, they took down the wall in front, replacing it with a steel and glass partition from Weldwork. The result is a less formal setup. We achieved openness and connection while still giving them defined, intentional spaces, Virginia Pano, the firm's principal designer, says. The bonus? Natural light. So there's a photograph here that indicates for all of the furnishings, accessories, the particular artists, the designers associated with. So they did install a freestanding island in the kitchen because the second sink was a must. The team shortened it, understanding that the family would eat meals at the dining room table. Second place, the designer shopped with the owners for stone. Third, another smaller, New kitchen with more storage thanks to cabinetry that climbs to the ceiling. Their slim, shaker-style fronts feel clean, but not too sleek with the island's black-brown stain. Translucent mirrored finish by Urban Electric and Company pendant enlarges the sense at the top of the room. It was all about finding the right scale in a style different from the chandelier so as not to compete while still relating to it in form. In the living room, there is drapery with metallic gold and charcoal threads and tiebacks to the colors in the kitchen, while the undulating motif relates to the veining of the marble and provides a sense of depth at the far end of the space. And last part of the renovation, a waterfall top on the peninsula creates a moment of modernity next to a traditional chandelier and crown moldings. We wanted to balance the architecture with modern aesthetic, Pano says. Now, a very different article, Love Letters, Me First. I think I'd be happier if my relationship were over. I've been in a situationship for a while. It started as a loving relationship, but he has a lot of issues. I wish he could be more proactive about addressing the issues, but he needs a lot of help, and I can't be the one to give him that help. So it's grown into more of a situationship. It's helped that I've been busy with college, but that ends soon. I think my question is, how do I know when to choose me, when to choose not having to be unhappy? I continue to remain in this relationship. Maybe it just hasn't gotten to a boiling point yet. Maybe I'm not trying hard enough to leave. Then sometimes I wonder, maybe the grass isn't always greener on the other side and I shouldn't leave. Maybe it's one of those things where we just have to buckle up for the long haul in sickness and in health. But if he won't help himself, he's just hurting everyone else around him. So this is, she signs herself as Lost. And so here's an answer to her questions. I can't be the one to give him that help. That sounds true. What keeps you in a relationship that isn't good for you? Maybe love and care for an important person. Maybe routine. Perhaps you're also a little afraid of being on your own. It can feel strange to be single after spending time with somebody who demands attention. It can be daunting to think about having all the time in the world to be your own person. When you think about walking away from this, what scares you? What worries you? Would it help to dive into that life and see how it feels? The grass is greenest saying works best when describing people who have reason to love what they have but can't stop from wondering about other options. It doesn't apply to someone who is unhappy in their current relationship. You do not have to sign up for sickness and health when someone who can't make you happy. If you're sticking with grass as a metaphor, it's pretty clear, and in parentheses, to me at least, that the grass will be greener on the other side of whatever this is. I can't promise it will look that way immediately, but probably after a few months. At the very least, the grass will be the new landscaping, a new perspective. Don't you want to see it? And that was a response from Meredith. And Meredith Goldstein says you can always send her letters and send your relationship quandaries and questions to the Love Letters column at the Globe. Letters, columns and responses are edited and reprinted from the Boston.com Love Letters. So let's, I think we have pretty much covered every article. But there are comments from previous articles. This was about On the Clock. If someone had read this previously, these are comments that come into the Globe and they print them. Benjamin Nymphy's Touching Connections captures the heartbreak of losing a beloved pet. Connections is always at the very end of the magazine, one page, and this is in response to an article about losing a pet. It acknowledges the fleeting beauty of raising children. He reminds us to acknowledge the fragileness and brevity of life, but also to relish the present. Another reader writes, Nymphy writes that love is short, to which I always add, and it gets shorter every day. Enjoy the here and now. Another writer responded, I love this. I look forward to reading these 650-word pieces. They often touch my heart. There was another one, another article about tax. Trump's tax on Harvard is more than a vendetta. And this writer is responding that it would it would be nice if universities made a bigger local tax contribution to the communities and housed more of their increasing student populations in their vast property holdings. Another responder, I'm sure that many reasonable people look at the endowments of Harvard, MIT, and Yale and ask, what do they need all of that money for? Can't they afford to pay a little bit more in taxes? The endowments are invested, and proceeds are used to pay workers, not just professors, but administrators, janitors, student workers, research scientists, etc. This strategy is to ensure that these institutions will be able to function long into the future without having to worry about funding. As an example of the fallout, the increase in the taxes paid by MIT will create a $300 million annual shortfall, consequences of which will be borne by laid-off workers as well as students who will see class sizes increased, the value of their degree lessened, and their libraries closed. Another reader responds to the article, nonprofits do have a public mission and are required by law to use their funds toward that mission, even though they are, and this is in quotes, private organizations. Endowments cannot be used for anything outside that stated mission. There are laws governing that, and those laws benefit you and me, the public. Another response to that article, a handful of elite universities carry out much of the basic scientific research that drives our tech economy. Then responding to a different article, this is called Backseat Drivers. Thanks to Spencer Buell for writing this perspective, slip sliding away on the red line. This was from a June 14th article. And I agree, says the reader. The seats are so uncomfortable, as are the seats on the new buses. They're especially uncomfortable for people who have a bad back. I wish I could advocate for them to be replaced, but I guess we're stuck with them. Another reader responding to the red line. I regularly take orange and red line trains from Jamaica Plain to Cambridge and back. With the announcement, when the announcement comes on that, in quotes, a train with all new orange or red line cars is approaching, there is an audible groan from passengers on the platform. Another response about riding on the T. What do they want? Paddled leather recliners? Yet one more response. This is why people hate the T. Commuters are rarely considered in decisions that might improve their daily travel. And a last response. Wow, people will complain about anything. I'm much happier sitting on the new, clean, red plastic seats in new, red-lined cars than the filthy, smelling fabric seats in the old cars. Let's stop complaining about every little thing and appreciate how far the tea has come in the last couple of years. So that brings us to an end of, you know, the Globe magazine's entire magazine written, you know, from July 19th. So, in closing, you are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML/FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you.
Very fast timeline, Benson said. We're really encouraging local cities and towns to take this issue up in the meantime, because we don't have any guarantees that this will get done this year. Pam.
Small museum, big North End story. There's a new historical stop along the Freedom Trail, and tourists will find it tucked away somewhere between Paul Revere's house and their next bowl of pasta. The North End Historical Museum opened this week after years of efforts to preserve the neighborhood's unique history. The North End is not only steeped in the lore of the American Revolution, but it's also as one of the city's earliest and richest immigrant meccas. Sitting at 3 Prince Street, a stretch between Hanover Street and North Square known to the locals as Little Prince, the museum was fashioned out of a gutted ground floor condo. When restaurateur Frank DePasquale bought the modest property last year, the only adornments were the exposed brick and electrical wiring. But for Tom Damangella, president of the North End Historical Society, the spot was perfect for his long-cherished dream of a permanent home to share the neighborhood's history, and one that he felt had never quite gotten its due. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center's reading of the Boston Globe. Have a great weekend.
These are the death notices from Friday, July 24th, 2026. From Boston, Christopher Annie Affleck, Michael Keith Fantasia, and Louise F. Greeley. From Cambridge, Christopher Annie Affleck. From Canton, Louise F. Greeley. From Chestnut Hill, Rose Gavris. From Mashpee, Louise F. Greeley. From Milton, Major General Thomas H. Needham. From Needham, Rose Gravers. From Norwood, Michael Keith Fantasia. From Osterville, Rose Gavers. From Plymouth, Louise F. Greeley. From Quincy, Major General Thomas H. Needham. From Rockland, Michael Keith Fantasia. From Somerville, Michael Keith Fantasia. From Stoneham, Jean M. Marino. From Wellesley, Rose Gavris. From West Roxbury, Michael Keith Fantasia. From Weston, Rose Gavris. From Westwood, Louise F. Greeley. And from Woburn, Jean M. Marino. This concludes the death notices for today.
Loved one owns a gun, and for a while now, you've been concerned about their behavior. They're just not acting like themselves. They've been distant. They've been unpredictable. They've been lashing out. They've been saying things that make you worried they might harm themselves or friends or family. Or you're worried this loved one might hurt you. Maybe they recently threatened someone with their gun. You know something needs to be done, and you wish more than anything you could hit pause on this situation. Well, here in Illinois, you can, with a firearm restraining order. In extreme cases, this order temporarily prevents a person in crisis from having a firearm, giving them time to heal before they do something dangerous or even deadly. If you are worried about a loved one in crisis who has access to a firearm, learn more about firearm restraining orders at illinois.gov/pause to heal. A public service announcement brought to you by the Illinois Department of Public Health, Brady, and the Ad Council.